Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another edition of your favourite podcast, Insane in the Membrane.
Insane in the Membrane.
Here we are, another week, another edition. I tell you what, I am still loving doing these, and I am still loving the fact that you love us doing them. It's the highlight of my week, recording these. I really enjoy it. The guests are always brilliant. You guys are brilliant for listening. Thank you for all the messages and all the back and forth that we have online. I absolutely love it. It's fucking brilliant. So thank you for that. It's been all right. Things are falling back into place slowly but surely. Gigs are happening. I've had my first few gigs, then they've gone well. Although I think I talk about it on this episode where I hadn't done my material in months and I forgot most of it and had to kind of wing it. But luckily, they're a very appreciative audience and they helped me get through it. And it was fun. So thank you to everyone at the Temple Cafe for my first gig back. You were ace. And if you find yourself down that way, down near Chalkwell Park, get yourselves in there. It's a wonderful little place. It's lovely. And it's Elvira, is it Elvira, I think her name is? I might be wrong, and I'm sorry if that is the case, but Elvira, that owns the calf, she's excellent. Temple Calf in Chalkwell. So before we get into this episode, I'd like to tell you also that we've got another edition of Insane in the Fembrain is coming out simultaneously with this one. And this week, I was joined by Danny St. James, a trans woman, that I've met a couple of times, but I'd never really spoken to someone about what it feels like to be trans and what you go through. So it was the perfect opportunity to find out, and so we had a really good chat. There's a link and things to do with that episode on this, so you can click on that. That'll take you to Fembrain, and I'm going to tell you now, it's a brilliant chat. Danny is excellent. She's really good. She was great to chat to. I really learned a lot. It was enlightening and inspiring. It's fantastic. So click on the link. That'll take you to Fembrain. So that's coming out exactly the same time as this one. My guest this week on Insane in the Membrane is broadcasting legend Mr. Jeff Lloyd, and it was very surreal for me because I've been a fan of Jeff's for many years. I used to have his show on when I used to drive to gigs at drive time, and so to actually having met him and actually, you know, have him on the show, it's quite surreal hearing his voice, like having a conversation with him that wasn't him doing his show. It was excellent, you know, and it was really nice chatting to him. We're of a similar age, so we talked about very similar things, us growing up, very, you know, I mean, he's from sort of Manchester way, I'm from the south, but it was interesting to hear that we had very similar backgrounds, you know. So it was nice. He's a lovely bloke, and I'm looking forward to having a coffee with him when we can. So do you know what, I'm waffling again. Let's get into it in just a moment. Jeff Lloyd.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We're looking for a sponsor to help get this brilliant conversation to an even bigger audience. Sponsoring the show, as well as a promotional trailer, means that your message and our message will be inserted into some of Acast's biggest podcast titles. Get on board and partner with Insane in the Membrane. Go to pauldaniels.tv for more information.
It's lovely to have you on, Jeff.
It's nice to hear your voice.
And you, mate. It's been ages.
Yeah, I know. It was when Sarah did a musical, wasn't it? I think about
that's it. Yeah.
Very, very briefly, we passed.
That's it. Yeah. Are you still, because you were doing the podcast with Ed? Is that still going on?
Yeah. We've been doing it remotely through all this.
How are you finding that? It was a bit sketchy with us to start with, but I've got producer Paul to sort all that shit out. So,
yeah, it's surprisingly. So Mike, because I'm sitting here in essence in a home studio, my bit is always fine. It's Ed is fucking useless though with technology. I just sent him last week. I sent him this pair of good headphones because basically he was forgetting to plug in his iPhone headphones, and every guest, they were on speakerphone, and it was making it a nightmare for Emma, who edits and produces
it.
So I sent him these headphones, and I didn't let him know they were coming in. He rang me up last Thursday night. He went, "I am so touched. A beautiful pair of headphones just arrived for me. That's so kind." And he thought they were just a present. And I had to explain they'd sort of come out of the podcast money and that.
That's it.
He was driving everybody insane. But I really wanted to take credit for being a thoughtful person who buys nice presents. Only I'm not.
I know.
Speaking of technical incidents, hello, Rich.
Hello, Paul.
Really?
I know.
You don't want to fess up, do you, Rich? You haven't got anecdotes to tell, have you, Rich, by any chance?
Here he is. We had Rob Rouse on the other day, and Rob Rouse's internet connection is pretty bad. So he, just in case, he recorded his end, and I was supposed to record mine. And as we got into it, my Zoom thing said it needed new batteries, so I quickly grabbed a load of batteries and shoved them in. It turns out they were duds as well, and I only got 10 minutes in of recording my side.
We had Lauren Laverne on once, and I forgot to record her mic. Which wasn't good. So then our producer had to grab the bits of her that had bled into our mics when we weren't speaking and try and salvage it out of that.
God. Well, I don't know. I even toyed with the idea of maybe listening to it and then just responding as if I was if it was a live thing.
Right.
I don't know. I just haven't, because he really thought about it. He really put the effort in.
Yeah.
And he really went to town, and then that happened. And I know Rob, he's a decent dude. So I imagine if I tell him, he'll be fine and up for it again. But, you know, it's quite, he got, not really personal, but personal enough that, you know, he might not want to rake over it again. I don't know. I'll speak to him.
Ugh, sometimes these things are better second time. I mean,
well, that's it. Yeah, maybe. Maybe a little bit of a run up and he'll, we'll see. But that's the thing with this. Sometimes it's, like I say this every time, there's no big introduction. This is just us. We just get on with it like this.
Yeah.
And it goes wherever you want to go. It can be as personal as you like. Like mental health is sort of the jumping off point. It's just people chatting and telling their stories. And from that, people take from it what they will. It's more about people saying, you know, you'll talk about maybe something that's happened to you and how you dealt with it. And then someone listening will go, oh, that happened to me. And it's just
gives them
a comfort that it's not just them that it's happened to. So,
I mean, I'll warn you, I always think I'm a terrible guest on other people's podcasts. You know, I'm so much more comfortable asking questions than I am.
Of course.
Answering them really. Like I've done a few, like I did Scroobius Pips a few years ago.
Lovely.
I did that two-shot podcast.
Oh, nice.
About a year ago, and with both of those, you know, because they are chats. I mean, yours is its own thing, but there's a similarity in that the chats where you kind of get into it, and for days afterwards, I'm like, oh fucking hell, like, or I just like end up treating these things like they're a therapy session. I don't. You know, think about whether this is an interesting story, whether there's any arc to it, whether I'm making it funny. I just sort of end up blurting out all these non sequiturs. I think I'm an awful guest on other people's podcasts.
Well, this sounds like it's perfect for this one. You can, because sometimes I'll start talking and I'm like, where am I going with this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's, you know, because I've only been doing this a year and a half now. Whereas you've been doing it, how long have you been in broadcasting for? You've been a long time.
Yeah, so I think my first paid radio show was 1991. So that's, you know, nearly 30 years, yeah, isn't it? And before that, you know, when I was a kid at school, I would go into my local radio station, Piccadilly Radio, and do anything I could to get on the air. I think when I was 14, I used to go on the air there doing film reviews, which was great because one of my first ever dates was I asked a girl who worked in the local McDonald's to come with me while I reviewed a film at the Odeon in Manchester, you know. So the free tickets were really impressive to her.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
At the time, it didn't work out well. It was sort of unrequited, and I used to go and sit in the McDonald's. This doesn't paint me in a good light, I'm well aware, but I used to go and sit in the McDonald's in Macclesfield while she was on her shift. And, you know, I was poor, so because I was a child, yeah. So I'd get the cheapest thing on the menu, which was a carton of milk, which I think was 30p. And I would sit there, like, nursing this carton of milk and sort of wistfully watching her mop up around me and get, like, snatches of conversation from her here and there when I could. She broke my heart in the end, though, Rich.
Oh, mate, I'm sorry. I've had similar stories. I remember there was a girl I really liked. She was my friend's sister, and she said, yes, we'll go out, but my friends are going to be there. So then my friends, her brother and my friends came with us, and we ended up, I didn't speak to her and all night. I couldn't bring myself to speak to her. And we just followed, there was their group and our group. We just followed each other around the park, just walking, and we didn't talk to each other at all.
There's a lot of following, isn't there? Young teenagers, like a lot of walking past people's houses and following, which does sound upsetting and stalky by today's standards.
Yeah.
But that's what, like, me, I used to have Eddie from next door was my best mate, and then we had this friend called Nick whose nickname was Womble because it sounded like one ball, and he'd been into hospital, and of course the rumour then went round school that he'd gone into hospital to have one of his balls removed, which I don't think there was any truth to it, but from that moment on he was called Womble. And all we would do every night, and it feels like it was years, but maybe it was just like one summer or whatever, we'd just walk round the street and we'd plot a route going past the houses of girls we fancied. And, you know, hope that maybe they'd be looking, like, none of us would be brave enough to go and knock on the door or go to a phone box and say, oh, is Rachel there? Will she come to? We just sort of walk past and just hope that we'd catch a glimpse of them, which we never did.
There was loads of that. I remember there was a girl, the first girl I ever kissed, Claire Sanders, at the school disco. I was 12. And then I just wanted to see her all the time. And I didn't understand the feelings. I just really liked her. And then a little while after, she said, no, you're ugly, you can piss off. But I still liked her. And I used to walk a certain way home from school just in case I saw her. And every time I saw her, she'd just take the piss out of the way I walked.
Brutal. Yeah, you're ugly, so you can piss off. The girl I had the big crush on was Rachel Leonard, and she once said to me, I would go out with you, but all my friends would laugh at me. So brutal.
And this is why later on, I think we're all like, our self-esteem is in the gutter. You don't realise, but later on, I should pretend that I'd been record shopping, so I look cool. I had records under my arm, and just in case I saw her, I'm like, oh, hey, yeah, I've just been out doing this. Total knobby things, really stupid. But you
still walked like a twat, though, Rich.
I still did. I had this swagger, and they used to take the piss. I didn't even know I was doing it. I used to just, like, it wasn't even a cool one. It wasn't even like a monkey one, like Liam Gallagher. It was like I used to just sway from side to side. I don't know.
What year were you born?
Dick. I was born in 72.
Right, so we're about the same age. I'm 73.
Yeah. Yeah.
So where was that walk coming from then?
I have no idea. I think I thought it was cool. This kind of strutting, swaggering rubbish. I don't know. The thing. I remember talking to Andrew Maxwell a few years ago, and we were talking about being cool. And he said, well, you're 40% less cool than you think you are. You know,
is this a rule for anyone?
I think so, yeah, with anyone. Right. Like, you might think, yeah, you think you're having a good day, and then you're like, yeah, take about 40% off that.
See, I've never, ever felt cool in my life. That's never been my assumption. It's like, you know, I feel in some way my wife has made a fundamental compromise by being with me. And I really think she loves me. And I think, you know, we enjoy each other's company. We talk to each other, you know, constantly. I never tire of having conversations with her. But I don't think anybody would look at me and go, oh, yeah, he's the one. Like, he's the type. No, but they wouldn't. I mean, just think about it. Like, if there's a load of blokes in a magazine, nobody's looking at the magazine and go, oh, I want one that looks like that. That's not what I offer in life. So on some level, she's made a compromise by being with me.
I would love it if you were my dad. That's where I am at now. You'd be, I wish you were my dad. You know, that it's not, people feel comfortable in my presence. I'm not a threat in any way, shape, or form. They just, not that I ever was, but that kind there isn't, I'm not going to try it on.
It's nice, isn't it? Because I've sometimes worried, you know, if I go into a cafe and I'm needy for other people's approval. So, I'm an uncomfortable social presence, but I go out of my way to be friendly. Yeah. And then I can get into, oh, God, what if they think I'm flirting with them? I remember years and years ago, when I was doing a late night radio show, I used to go to this cafe from about, I don't know, 7 till 9 in the evening and just scribble notes. And I always thought I looked insane because I'd have a piece of paper and I'd write things to talk about at the top of the paper. And I thought, like, if you didn't know what I did for a living, that looks like a crazy person writing things to talk about. Anyway, I went in there so often. There was one time one of the waitresses gave me a free cup of tea.
Oh yeah.
and I felt sort of so overwhelmed by it. I said, "Oh, I'll have to get you a drink sometime." And as it came out of my mouth, I thought, "Oh no, it looks like I'm asking her for a drink. That's not what I meant. It's just I'm so uncomfortable with somebody being kind to me and giving me something." And you know, so I could never go back in there again. But there was a reason I mentioned that. Anyway, I now feel that I am of an age and a type of presence where nobody would ever think I was flirting with them. I think I'm a completely benign sexual presence and I don't need to worry about that anymore.
Exactly. I'm the same. It's just, yeah, I don't need to. I don't require it. People don't require it from me. It's just, it's actually nice being, not having that anymore. It's
being
a really
neutered.
Nice feeling.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Being eunuchs is in essence, people see us as eunuchs.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a nice place to be. I know friends that they're not in relationships and they're forever chasing something. And you're just like, I just look at them like, it seems exhausting. I don't.
Yeah, no matter how miserable your relationship is, just stick with it. Yeah. Stick in that rut. You don't want to be out there, do you?
Keep looking at all the little bits that do work.
Cling on. like in a shipwreck.
Where did you meet Sarah?
So I met Sarah. I was doing my old radio show from New York for a week, and my co-host Annabelle was a fan of The Moth, which I hadn't heard of at the time, and I'm extremely familiar with now. It's a storytelling organization in America, and it's true stories told live. That's their essence. That's their slogan, and at one end of the spectrum, like the grand end of the spectrum, they'll hire enormous venues and you'll have people like Neil Gaiman or whoever telling true stories. And then at the other end, they do these things called story slams, which is not far from an open mic night, in that people just turn up. There's a theme, so say it's revenge. People turn up, they put their names in the hat, and if you get drawn out, you go on stage and you've got 5 minutes to tell your story. Once you've finished it, you get judged by panels of judges in the audience, just made up of audience members, and then there's a winner, and then they go through to the Grand Slam, and then they can end up on these main stages, as they're called, with these sort of famous people. Yeah. Anyway, so they also record it. It's a huge radio show on National Public Radio in the States. It's also a massive podcast worldwide. And Annabelle, my co-host, was a big fan of that radio show, so wanted to go and see one of the live events, which we did at the bitter end in in New York, in Manhattan. It's a very famous club, like Woody Allen played there as think in his early days as a stand-up, but also, you know, lots of musicians have played there. I think Dylan, Woody Guthrie, these types.
Bloody hell. But,
and they do these moth story nights, and it was the last Monday, I think, in January, it was freezing, like 10 degrees minus outside. And there's this huge queue of hipsters, like, waiting to get in. So you can tell, oh, this is a bit of a scene. Yeah. So anyway, we go in, and Sarah was the host of the night. Before she was a comedian, she was a comic, because my wife, explain, my wife is a comedian. She was sort of a comic essayist. She'd had a book out, and she was working on the second book, and all of this had come about because she was involved in these nights where you go on stage and tell true stories. And she was the host of the one in New York, and just remember watching her and thinking she was brilliant. Anyway, we're doing this week of shows from New York. We had a guest drop out, and I said, oh, we should ask her on. So She came on a couple of days later, so I'm very lucky in that my first conversation with her was on the air. You know, it's on tape somewhere.
Nice and safe.
Yeah.
There's an actual reason for her to be in the room with you and not. That's excellent. I like that. I like that. And now look at you, married, kids.
Yeah.
No looking back now.
A lot of compromises made. No.
I tell you what, what is surreal for me is listening to your voice now. As we're talking, because I've been a fan of yours for a long time. Okay. I used to listen. The Drive Time show was on.
Yeah, yeah.
Whenever I'd be going to gigs and things like that, and I remember there was one where I think when you weren't going to be doing it anymore, and that you were talking about it's going to be me, or you were explaining you were going to be doing another show, and I remember that it was a real. It sounded there was a sadness in your voice. And I don't know if that was just, well, you probably don't remember, but.
I moved around a lot over the years. So this was Virgin Radio, which then became Absolute Radio. So when I started there, I was on an evening show. It was me and a guy called Pete. We're in a double act, Pete and Jeff.
Oh, yeah.
Then we sort of did Drive Time. Then we moved to a breakfast show. And then when that finished, you know, I didn't want to do the double act anymore. And I'd always loved late night radio. So I moved to the Monday to Thursday 10 o'clock at night, which was to this day my favorite thing I've ever done on radio. I just loved being on at that time of night. Then Annabelle and myself moved to the Drive Time after that. But you know, we bounced around all over the place, and you know, I just stayed there a little bit too long.
Right.
I think I was there 18 years in total. Wow. And at 15 I was ready to go. And this is the least glamorous reason for sticking in a job, but I'd had a bunch of building work done. I thought, well, if I can just stick it out another 3 years, it'll recoup what I've spent on the building work. So, which is no reason to do anything. I think you should just do something, you know, if you're in the position to do something because you're enjoying it and because it's something you'd listen to. And I sort of broke my own rule and ended up staying a bit longer than I'd wanted to. Yeah. So, you know, when I was ready to go, I was ready to go. I was in a position where really I was really lucky in that I was doing this job where I could kind of do whatever I wanted to. Like it ended up like the last couple of years of the show were a combination of sort of dicking around like we'd always done and then talking to astrophysicists and neuroscientists and stuff, which really has no place on commercial radio. But I was just sort of allowed to do what I wanted to. But even so, it's like just scratching at the door a little bit. I was ready to do something else. Yeah.
That's all right. So it wasn't sad. It was relief by the sound of it.
No, but it was sad in that, you know, saying it out loud, because I'd known, you know, like I say, I'd known for 3 years that I was ready to go, and I'd known that I was going, and behind the scenes it was known for a long time before that. But that being said, it still felt sad. And then you know what it's like with radio shows and podcasts. You'll have it with this podcast. The people who like it really like it, and they'll get in touch with you and they'll say, oh god, you know, you said this once and I was going through this in my life. You know, it can be very moving. So when you make an announcement like that and you see the reaction, it can be a bit emotional, which it was.
Yeah, well, that's probably what I was picking up on. I remember driving, I don't remember where I was driving to, and I was like, oh, because like you say, you build up a sort of a relationship with those people, like They're just, you can become comfortable with it. You know, you go to a gig and you hear those voices and you're like, yeah, we're doing this again. You know, there's on a level you feel like you know this person.
Yeah. And I think for, you know, probably for 70% of the audience of most music radio shows, especially commercial radio shows, it's just a noise that's on in the background, right? You're not really paying attention to it. And I don't think most of the people, you know, it had a lot of listeners that show, and I think for most of the people I was just like the interruption between a Coldplay record and a Stereophonics record, but you know, but they were willing to put up with it. But for the chunk of people who really liked it, there was a connection there, and we would podcast the show every day and we'd always do those extra bits. And for the people who really liked it, when I said it was finishing, I was really overwhelmed. People who had remembered their first day at school and then were having kids of their own or whatever.
Wow.
And you know, I'm a bit pathetic. I'm too easily moved, really. I'm sure you'll have me in tears on this podcast. So to get a lot of messages like that, and it was a lot at the time, it can be really overwhelming and lovely.
It is nice, isn't it, when people because I do this, and then sometimes I'm like, oh, you know, you have a moment, you go, does anyone give a fuck about this? And then I'll get a message from someone and they'll say, mate, you said this thing and it really resonated, and I've been going through similar and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, shit, this does help people. You know,
I had this day, because, I mean, I think I was always, like, part of my thing on the radio is, like, whatever's going on with me, I'll try and be as honest as possible, as long as I can try and make it funny or entertaining or interesting or whatever, as long as there's some value to it, I'll try and talk about it on the air. But I didn't really, not for any reason, but I didn't really talk about mental health stuff probably because I thought, oh, I don't make this funny, or does it sound indulgent, or does it. And then the day Robin Williams died, I started talking about it, and what I was specifically talking about was this idea that, oh, but he was a genius and the cost of genius is to be tortured and tormented like that. And it really upset me that mental health was presented in that way, because it's a sort of stupid glamorization of it, and it's something that affects, you know, a genius and somebody just getting on with their life in, you know, any old circumstance the same. And I ended up just talking, and I don't know how long I talked for, but it was a long time in terms of, if you think about what the bits that go between records are, maybe it was like 15 or 20 minutes or something. And it was this real outpouring, and it was more raw than I was accustomed to being on the radio, because even though I thought, oh well, I'll always share my life, you know, you're in control of it a bit as well. And I got to the end of what I was saying, and I hadn't made, like, throughout it, I hadn't really made eye contact with Annabelle, my co-host, or Gareth, who was the producer at the time. And I turned the microphones off and I couldn't look at them. You know, I thought, oh, I've just really embarrassed myself by being overly earnest here. Like, earnestness isn't something that sits well with me. And then the messages started coming in.
Yeah, right. And people were really touched by it. What you said.
It wasn't, oh, you know, you've articulated this brilliantly. It wasn't that I'd said anything special or said anything particularly well. It was more that what it then did was gave people permission, I suppose, to tell me about their lives. And I didn't then treat that, okay, I'm going to spend the rest of the show reading out people's stories. But I then came home and I think spent a day or a day and a half replying to these messages. And it was, you know, a lot of people telling me about suicide attempts, you know, how close they had got to taking their own life, and how a little thing, be it, you know, a thing that we'd done on the radio or a song had played on the radio or something, had just changed it for them. And, you know, I was in bits. I was in absolute bits. I was just sort of sitting sobbing for a day. But, you know, given that what I said before, I just assume that most of the people hear what you do on the radio is blah, it's just noise in the background. It's amazing that it cut through to people in that way. It was genuinely amazing.
It was so unexpected as well. Like you say, your bits, there's a bit of banter in between the songs.
Yeah.
And then onto the songs. But you actually took a moment to actually go, do you know what? Subconsciously, you just went, I just want to talk about this for a minute. And those moments are really, they're really special.
Especially if it's not your shtick. If your shtick is really to go on the air every day and sort of talk in an earnest or emotive or impassioned way about what's going on in the world, people expect it from you. But I think, you know, if most of the time you are just, you know, being daft or inane or whatever, yeah.
But you're an emotional person then, you admit that.
It's pathetic though. This came up. I wonder if I can find the email. Let me just see if I can find this. This came up on the podcast I do with Ed Miliband the other week. He was talking about he'd been to his son's graduation. And when I say his son's graduation, his son graduating at the age of 11 from primary school.
Yeah, well, they do that now, don't they?
Yeah. And I was saying, when it had been my son's graduation from the baby unit of nursery up into the preschool unit of nursery, they invited us in and they had tea and cake and they made a little speech. And I was crying so much that it wasn't like, oh, look at that, you know, look at that beautiful dad who's in touch with his emotions. Isn't that a nice thing to say? I think I embarrassed my wife and I made everybody feel uncomfortable because it was that kind of sobbing, like,
oh, wow.
Anyway, so I sort of described it as pathetic, and somebody wrote into Reasons to Be Cheerful, and they said, they quoted, in this week's podcast, Ed says to Jeff, you're a man who shows his emotions, which is really good. And then Jeff interrupts to say, I show them too much, though. It's a bit pathetic. And I'm happy to say that Ed replies, I don't think it is. That's been unnecessarily self-deprecating. And then she says, why don't you do an episode about the pressure you feel about describing your emotions as pathetic? And I'm genuinely not that person. There is nothing stoic or traditionally macho about me at all.
No.
I'm really fine showing my emotions. But there is a point at which it's too much and it makes everybody uncomfortable. And my wife is the same. Our wedding, when she came down the aisle, it was a small wedding, we only had 30, 35 people, and she came down the aisle with her dad, and she was crying in such a way, it was like she was being held hostage and there was some kind of arranged marriage thing going on. And again, it was one of these things where she's coming down the aisle like it's that kind of crying. And I think some people were laughing because it wasn't moving. It was
too much.
Ridiculous. And she's American, as we've established. Mm. And you know, so the speeches were a bit more earnest, I guess. They were funny. I mean, she was so funny in her speech and her dad was brilliant and so on. But there was a bit more earnestness and tears. And you know, the Americans and the Brits were in tears. It was sort of not a dry eye in the house jobby. And I think the British people who were at our wedding resent me to this day for putting them in a situation where they showed emotion so publicly. It wasn't good.
I'm the same though. Society around me kind of said, oh, yeah, man up, men don't cry, that sort of thing.
But yeah.
I cry all the time. I do cry a lot. And I always felt stupid doing it. And it's only been in the last few years that everyone's going, no, it's fine. You're completely fine to cry whenever. And I do. I cried at Phantom of the Opera. I blubbed my eyes out when we went to see that. I cry at films. I cried when I went to see Jojo Rabbit.
I mean, these are very moving things. I mean, there isn't much that I won't cry up. I mean, I wish Sarah's gone out to get her nails done. Otherwise, I'd sort of get to come upstairs and start listing things I've cried at, because it's like I cried at anything with a montage. I cried when Lance and Martin left Home and Away, the montage when Gabby Roslin left The Big Breakfast. I mean, just any kind of montage will do for me.
Yeah,
most adverts, anything of people. I'll tell you the one that always gets me: people rallying round in a TV show or a film. If people rally round at your hour of need. That really sets me off. Paying me a compliment, I can't handle it. It's all very difficult for me.
I'm the same. If someone said something nice to me, yeah. I immediately come back with six things for them, and I can't help myself.
Yeah.
Instead of just going, oh, thank you, that's very kind. I'm like, but you're great at rock climbing and you're really good at this. And I'm like, fucking hell.
I know. It almost feels like there's something big-headed and accepting the compliment.
Yeah. And like I say, the world around me was telling me to be a man and there was a way of being a man, but my dad wasn't really like that. I mean, yeah, he did. Sometimes he'd say, pull yourself together, you know, but not... He wasn't like that.
My dad is like that.
Oh, really?
So my brother is much more like my dad, and I don't think I've ever seen my brother cry in adulthood, and I would be very surprised if he did. My dad is that guy, you know, all these people saying it's so difficult with social distancing and lockdown because I just want to be able to hug my parents. My dad is horrified if I ever tried to hug him. He'd be happier if I tried to mug him, in fact.
Yeah.
It's like, if I try to hug him, he will go, "Bugger off, what are you, bloody queer?" Which is not just homophobic, but it has a very strange grasp. Like, no, Dad, I'm not, as it happens, and nor have I been secretly harbouring this crush on you throughout my life, which I am now ready...
You mentioned that.
to reveal in the form of a hug.
My dad is getting better at it. In fact, he will push himself towards me knowing that I'm going to hug him. So,
right.
You know, he's there now. Whereas before, it used to be arms down by his side.
Yeah.
There's a laugh now when I turn up. I'm like, all right, Dad. And he knows it's coming. And he's like, all right. And then here we go.
What changed with him?
I think he just... I don't really know. I think I've just worn him down. Like, just keep telling him that I love him and things like that.
Because this is a bit bleak, but I was talking to my sister recently, and she lives close to my mum and dad. And, you know, my dad is gruff. If I go up there, he'll come and say, "You all right?" I'll say, "Yeah, not bad, Dad." And then he'll go up into his box room and he plays correspondence chess on the computer, and he doesn't really come out, even though I don't see them that often. He just goes, he's like really antisocial. He's got a lot worse as he's got older. And that's his reputation in our family as this curmudgeon. Anyway, I was talking to my sister and she said that he's been a lot nicer during lockdown. She'll go and sit at the end of their garden and he'll come out and talk to her, which is unheard of.
Yeah.
And she says it's because he's worried he's going to die, you know, because of COVID. And something about that is making him a lot nicer.
Well, that's the deal. I think there's something in that. My dad keeps giving me stuff.
Right.
Every time I see him, when I was a teenager, the way that he and I spent time together was going to see bands. He'd always get tickets to see bands.
So
my dad, I talked to my mate Marcus today about this, and he's like, "At least your dad introduced you to punk." He said, "My dad introduced me to the New Testament." You know, and I'm like, "Oh shit, yeah, that is really cool." And every gig we went to, Dad bought a T-shirt, and he never wore them. He just bought a T-shirt. And so I went around there a few weeks ago and he said, "Do you want those T-shirts?" And I'm like, "Yeah, go on." He's given me three holdalls full of old gig T-shirts.
Great.
Yeah,
that's brilliant.
And I was like, he goes, "Well, you can sell them. We do what you want." And I'm like, "I'm going to sell these. These are incredible, Dad."
Yeah.
And then I was thinking about it. I'm like, yeah, it feels like he's giving his stuff away, getting ready. Because he's 73. He's like, it really made me, I started crying in the car.
Yeah. I went to see them about a year ago, and I got there and my mum said, "Oh, I've been having a sort out, and I found a poem your dad had written me on the day your sister was born. It was beautiful." I'm thinking, this is not the man I know. Even, you know, I was six when my sister was born, and the idea that my dad, who is that sort of stereotypical gruff working class northern man.
Yeah.
Like, wrote my mum a poem.
Wow. When,
throughout my childhood, all I sort of knew was him sort of taking the piss out of an eye rolling at stuff my mum says. There's an affection there, but it's very much, you know, shared through that. That's the way he shows his affection, by being sarcastic and hostile. But the idea that he would have written a poem, it was mind blowing to me. I thought, well, isn't that beautiful? So I said, oh, can I read it? She said, oh, I threw it away.
What?
No! It's unbelievable, isn't it? That she'd sat on this thing for 40 years and then she said, oh, that's nice. Your dad read them straight in the bin with it. Unbelievable.
Oh, God. Well, I know there is a sensitive side to my dad, because I've said this before on here. There was we had shelves of literature. There was books everywhere, and you know, and I didn't necessarily read them, but I knew the names, and so there'd be poetry, there'd be art. So I knew it was in it. I knew it was in him. But
so where did that come from in him? Was that your granddad? Was that part of that, you know, the family he grew up in?
It was his mum. His mum was awful. She was a horrendous human being, made of granite. Dad said. Yeah, she was horrible, nasty woman. Even when she passed away, they hadn't spoken in ages. It was my cousin in Australia messaged me and said, how's your dad? And I'm like, I don't know, what do you mean? And he went, oh, Nan's passed away. I'm like, oh, shit. So I rang him up. I rang him, and mum answered. And I'm like, oh, mum, is dad there? And so I spoke to him, and I'm like, Dad, I'm really sorry, but Nan's passed away. Do you know this? And he's like, oh, I had nerd. And he leaned over to me mum, and he went, oh, my mum's gone. And I went, oh, okay. And he went, all right, thanks for that. I'll see you later. I'm like, all right, Dad, bye.
Just no. Yeah, it's so weird, isn't it? Like, I tried when my grandma died. You know, my grandma was, I think, drove him nuts in these ways, because she was funny, but she was hard work. She died at age 80, and I heard my mum. I said, oh, should I speak to my dad? I went, how are you doing, Dad? He went, yep, fine. I went, no, but how are you doing? You know, how are you doing? It's okay. You must be fine. No, fine. Put you back onto your mother. there's no getting into it with them.
They just won't have it, will they?
No.
Now he has opened up, and he does say, he's like, you know, she put my granddad through absolute hell.
Right.
And, you know, but then he in his own way as well, he didn't help matters. He was a bit of a dick to my dad as well. And, so my dad's, it's only in the last few years that I've realised the shit that my dad's been through that's made it. Because he was a very, I've said this before loads of times, very angry man when I was a kid. He loved us and did everything he could for us. But at the same time, there was an anger underneath, you know. Yeah, and now I know why. It's a shame. It is a shame. Yeah.
Do you ever get choked up thinking about your own child doing the eulogy at your funeral?
You've just put the seed in my head.
That's a nice little sort of daydream, mawkish daydream, if you ever want one.
Well, I try to avoid sadness because I know it really affects me. I've said this before. I don't like listening to sad music if I can help it. Jade will put sad music on all the time. She loves melancholy. I've got friends of mine that love it. They love that feeling and they embrace it. Whereas if I see something sad, I get affected by it for days and I can't shake it off. And I don't enjoy the feeling. I should really face it.
An example of something be? I mean, how sad are we talking?
I'm trying to think now. Just anything, really. Anything remotely sad. Like Jade will watch a film and she'll be excited that there's a death in it. You know, she loves a bit of death. There's a, you know, like my girl that I've never seen it because I know the story and I don't want to see it. But Jade, that's the sort of thing Jade will watch, you know, and I can't bring myself to do it.
I like a bit of that. I do. I like a bit of melancholy. I like a bit of tragedy. I'll tell you what film I watched, which I think is astonishing. I watched it again the other week. Have you seen Eighth Grade?
No.
It's one of it's somebody in your line of work who wrote and directed it. And I don't know about his comedy at all, but from this film, I think he's a genius. He's called Bo Burnham.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And
oh, he's excellent.
Oh, my God. This film. It's basically, I think, I guess if she's eighth grade, she's 13 going on 14. I think that's right. And it's just a girl who, you know, she's by no means a weird outsider nerd, but she's not one of the cool kids either. She's just very much in the middle. And it's just a very small story, really. It's her going from her reaching the end of middle school and about to go to high school. And it's so beautiful, and it captures so well what it is to be a teenager. And at the same time, it's really modern. You know, she makes videos for YouTube, and she's sort of scrolling through social media, and it's beautiful. It's one of the great, I'm a sucker for a coming of age film. Is one of the greatest coming of age films I've ever seen. But it, you know, it's also deeply melancholy. And yeah, when you think about a film like that, or a film, and this is a much sort of lighter film, like Mean Girls, I was thinking about the cool kids, the, you know, the cheerleaders, the kids who are good at sports. When those people grown up watch the classic sort of coming of age films, do they see themselves in the bad guys?
Oh yeah, as the cool kids. Or...
Do you see what I mean? Do you think? Oh yeah, I was the. You know, do you think I was the one who was awful to nerds, or do you not see yourself reflected in that way? Because I think, you know, anyone like me just sees themselves in the nerds or in the geeky, uncomfortable kids. And yeah. I was wondering about the alphas. What do they see, or do they just not enjoy those films because it's so far from what their experience was?
It's weird, isn't it? I hadn't thought about that. I was at school and I kind of knew the cool kids and I knew the nerds. I was definitely an in-betweener. Yeah. I was getting bullied, and then I'd bully someone else. And it was because in an all-boys school, it went on all the time. It was vile. But
you went to an all-boys school?
I did, yeah. Yeah. So that was very masculine and very much, there's no way that you're crying, you know, in an all-boys school in the 80s. I never even used the toilet. I used to go for a wee, but you'd never go for number two because you'd just get the door kicked in on you and you'd be spat on. And so I never had a shit at school for 5 years just because of that brutality. I saw it. There was a kid, Christopher Linard, who had learning difficulties. And I went in there one day and he was just getting wailed on. Everyone was just piling on him in this because he decided to have a poo at school. And I'm like, oh.
Awful. Like I was telling Sarah, who grew up in a she grew up, actually, if you think about all those sort of classic 80s teen films, Ferris Bueller, those sort of films, she grew up in that neighborhood. It's an area outside of Chicago where John Hughes made all his films.
Oh really?
So her mum and dad live in a very modest house, but this town is full of whatever your image of 80s American films is. She's surrounded by that. And Cameron's house from Ferris Bueller is like three streets away from where she grew up. Anyway, so which is to say that I think that experience of school is very different to like a working class British 1980s version of school. And I was telling, I'd been out with a school friend somewhat recently before lockdown, and I was telling her something he'd reminded me of, which was, and this is really, you know, it's really dark, but there was a kid in our class whose mum killed his dad.
Oh, wow.
And went back to, in our year, not making my class, but in my year. So in other words, like reading between the lines, it was domestic violence, and she'd done it in self defense, and I can't remember quite what became of her, but there was a kid in our year who, you know, went away for a while and then came back, and that was the circumstance that led to it. His mother had killed his father.
Wow.
When he came back from that day onwards, his nickname was Crime Watch.
Oh my god. Oh my god.
But just you describing that sort of experience of get if you dared to go to the toilet, you'd get spat on. I mean, that sort of brutality. It's exactly how it was. And I wonder if it's just the same now. I wonder if, you know, that experience isn't that different if we talk to like a 14-year-old, or if they have suddenly become sensitive. I don't know.
Well, I think they have. I mean, my lads are 23 and 28.
Right.
And I remember watching something years and years ago when they were younger. And I remember it was someone on the television, and they were very flamboyant, sort of very sort of Liberace kind of thing. So this would have been This would have been, it was back in the 90s, late 90s, and I remember watching it, and they came on, and I went, oh, look at him. And I remember my eldest going, oh, Dad. And I'm like, what? He went, do that. Why are you doing that? And he pulled me up on it.
Yeah.
So I think they are more aware than they were
great.
When we were
kids. And it's, and I love, this sort of sounds counterintuitive. In a way, I love any story which involves me or somebody my age being dragged out of the dark ages.
Yeah.
Because I think there can be a tendency to pretend that we were all as switched on to other people's plights as we are now. But we learned it, you know. There were some terrible things, I'm sure, that I've said in my younger days.
Oh, we all have,
not to say like I was ever in the National Front or anything. But like my attitudes towards things have evolved through hearing other people's stories, not through people going, you know, yelling at me about my opinions, but by just hearing what life is like for other people and then thinking, oh, yeah, that's recontextualized it for me. Now I understand that, you know, that language isn't appropriate, or if somebody heard that, they might feel like this, and, you know, all that stuff. And I hope that when we revisit this interview, you know, for the 1,000th episode, when you're 75 or whatever, like I hope there are things that I say and think today that I wince at, because the world has moved on and I've moved on with it.
Yeah.
And I've got a little bit of a beam up on it about people pretending that their attitudes were
exactly
as perfect 10, 20, 30 years ago as they are today.
Yeah. We've all said and done things that, you think back now, you go, oof, God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's great, because it means things are getting better and we're listening to each other more. And, you know, by listening to each other more, we're learning some empathy, and you know, things are slowly getting better. And I know you look at the news, you think actually things haven't got that much better, and you know, there's a truth in that as well. But I just really think here's an example. I used to have a friend who was my producer of radio show for a while, called Nelson, who's a black Londoner. And there was this one night where we were going somewhere and we were short on time, so I said, oh, we just hail a cab. We're standing on the corner of Brewer Street in Soho, and he stood there with his arm out, and three cabs with their lights on just go past him.
Right.
I'm like, what's going on? He says, oh, that happens all the time.
Oh,
so
God.
Not occurred to me that life is like that, because as far as I'm concerned, you know, we're living in London. I'm not saying that I was naive enough to think that racism was a thing of the past, but I'm thinking anybody kind of living a life similar to mine, they're not really encountering it. And that just really brought it home to me. You know, what we've now come to understand that term white privilege a lot better. But, I just hadn't occurred to me.
No. Well, I remember walking into a green room, and there was his name's Special P. Peter, his name is, and he was in the green room. And Gavin Ford as well. It's not Gavin Ford. His name's Kane Brown. Shit. His stage name's Kane Brown. But they're very fit, athletic type dudes. I remember walking into the green room, and they were kind of the talk of getting fit came up, and I made a comment about, well, your genetics are better than mine anyway, and they sort of looked at me like, really that's what you're going to say, right. And I didn't think about it. I just walked off, and it was later on I went, oh, fuck,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It was something that had been told to me, and I thought was at the time it was like, well, probably . Yeah, and it wasn't until later when I go, what a ridiculous thing to think, you know. And it's things like that, I think, you know, I think back, I go, oh, God.
Definitely. And you only sort of, if you're moving through the world in a certain way and you're only really encountering a certain type of person, you're not getting a sense of what life is like for other people. And it's moments like that which can just change things for you. It's brilliant.
Yeah, it is. And it's being, but that just goes to show that you're open to it, aren't you? You're like, I was thinking about this earlier, there's when I was growing up, certain things got said if you saw a black person, especially if you saw a black person in a flash car. It was always a derogatory thing. It was like, oh, I wonder what they've been up to get that.
Yeah,
you know, you know, that sort of thing. And it's only, so you go, yeah, racism is taught. Definitely, it's a taught thing. You don't grow up that way. Yes, yeah, so it's, yeah. So
but
if
it was
you can,
so
you know,
prevalent.
It was, yeah.
So, you know, obviously it's heinous if anybody actively holds those views. But I also think that we're products of the time we're living in and products of the culture we're living in. And it's just ignorance with a lot of people. And you've got to listen to other people's stories and life experiences. And that's what changes it for you.
Well, even Simon Pegg said in his book, you know, they used to do the Lenny Henry, the black voice in school.
Oh,
You know, you remember that? You know, decondensed milk and whatever else he was doing.
Yeah.
And that was,
I found myself singing the Vitalite advert to my son in an accent that I wouldn't want heard outside of the house. Really. I thought, oh, God, gotta stop that. Yeah.
On Bongo was everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
And then you go, oh shit! I'm glad, like you say, we're open to the. We're not those people, so we're open. We go, oh, if someone goes, yeah, you, what are you saying that for? That's not what you're supposed to. And you go, oh shit, yeah, sorry. It's not because we're full of hate. We just don't realise.
No, but I think I do think everyone or almost everyone is open. Like, there's that Michelle Obama saying, it's like it's hard to hate up close. I think if you can be in a position where you really can hear what life is like for somebody, I think it's difficult to hold that kind of prejudice. And I think, you know, racism, injustice, these things should be called out, and it shouldn't be on a minority's shoulders to explain what life is like to to an ignorant person or you know, somebody who holds a prejudice. But I think that's what moves stuff along, isn't it?
Yeah, really. Yeah. And like you say, and not waiting for things to happen, you kind of, you seek out information. This is the thing at the moment about educating yourself. And it hadn't even occurred to me until very recently to kind of go looking for the information. I was waiting for it to come to be flagged up, and then someone goes, well, these are the books you're supposed to be reading. And you go, oh, I'll go and read them then. But now, like I do with music, you kind of go, like, you know, you listen to hip hop, and they go, oh, well, that's a sample from that album and that person. And you go, oh, so you go in and you find out about Herbie Hancock.
Yeah, you follow the trail.
And that's what you should be doing with the literature. You should be,
I'm taking from this conversation, Rich.
Go on.
I'm taking that you and I are great white people.
We are great white people.
We're just so great. We're very open. We're willing to look at our own lives. Yeah, if you want me to slap you on the back, I'm willing to do that. I'd really love a pat on the back from you. I mean, I think we are just proving to the listeners, oh my God, we like the moral high ground that we're occupying. It's the view from up here is great, isn't it?
Isn't it wonderful? Rarefied air. I think I'm going to change the name to Insane in the Virtue Signalling. See, we've done it again. We get a bit ahead of ourselves, and then we go, oh no, let's slap ourselves down.
Yeah.
But it's nice to have these conversations with someone who's, you know, roughly my age, and talking about, you know, similar experiences and know it, like, because it's very easy to look back at those times going and say everybody was racist. Everybody was sexist and everybody was homophobic, and it wasn't the case. I think everybody's been trying to find all, you know, there is a lot of love from people as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I try not to think about shit I've done in the past, because I'm like, why am I, there's no point. I can't do anything about it. You know, I'm just lugging it around. There was a kid in our school. The story went round that they used to go to this house, and this guy used to have this house, and they used to go and hang out in this house. And he'd done something sexual to the guy. And so he got so much shit at school. I gave him shit. Everyone gave him shit. And then you think about it, you go, he was abused by this fucking guy.
And we just
gave him. And I think about him every day. There's always a moment when I go, fuck him. You know, and it. But I don't know. I can't do anything about it now.
No.
Yeah.
you know, that's not how you think now, is it? I mean, that's I'm not saying it makes things better for me.
No.
Like seeing that you know you're more evolved as a person, more open and thoughtful as a person than you were, because you know you're prone to any kind of anxiety. I think that's something you live with, isn't it? You're just going about your day normally, and all of a sudden you get a crippling memory of something you blurted out in 1986 or something like, oh God, why did I say that to that shop assistant? You know,
I know.
Yeah.
I know. Bill Burr has got a bit about that. He said, you know, he'd be in the shower and he'll just be hit with this memory. And he's like, oh God. And his wife's like, she's like, are you okay? And he's like, yeah, just the shower was a bit hot. She's like, every day? It does. But, you know, I'm trying to, I still fuck up. I still make mistakes. I'm still trying. You know.
Yeah, that's good though. You know, I just don't trust people who say they've got there, because there's always more that you can be fixing, isn't there?
Exactly. But like you say, the people that profess to have, that they came out of the womb and were just totally woke, totally on a level. They've never said anything offensive ever in their lives. They've never upset a soul.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, come on, man. What, are you an alien? Come on. Well, I like this. I like hearing that you're emotional. It makes me feel better knowing I'm not the only one that cries at car adverts.
I'm pathetic. Sarah, I can't remember what I said the other day, but Sarah thought I was about to burst out. I said something completely innocuous, like, you know, but I think we're taking our kid to a playground. Going, God, isn't this playground great? And she swears that she heard me get choked up as I was saying.
I tell you what, going back to what you were saying about your kids reading your eulogy, what really made me sad recently is my nan is now in a home. She's 91. And she's more or less there in her head, but she's now and again she'll disappear. But I was sat in her room, and all she's got she's got the bare minimum. She's got a couple of pictures, she's got a couple of bits of bric-a-brac, a couple of items of clothing, and I'm like, wow, 91 years, it's been whittled down to this. And I look around my flat at the stuff I've got, I'm like, fuck me, where is this going to go?
I used to live on Portobello Road in London, and I used to go past on a Saturday, you know, the antiques markets, and you would see boxes, which were basically somebody had done a house clearance, and as part of that house clearance were all the photos from somebody's life. And you just see like these boxes of everything that had ever been documented in someone's life just sat there, and you can buy them for 30p or postcards or whatever it is. And just, I mean, there's a real, you know, you can really get into some nihilism if you're not careful about about the value of a life, and you just think about a few bin bags full of stuff and then somebody rifling through your photos because, oh, look at them, they look so retro, look at the haircuts. I mean,
oh, I know, you're just going to become a trendy photo on a kitchen floor, on a kitchen wall.
An album cover if you're lucky. I said to, like, my son is 4 and I could not be more obsessed with him. Like, he is like a tap that I can turn on and feel joy at any time, and I just love spending time with him. And I'm lucky that, you know, I sort of do a minimum of 50%, sometimes more, depending on how busy Sarah is. And I just love him. And we were lying in bed the other night, Sarah and I, and said, oh God, I just want to go and look at him. I love him so much. And she said, oh no. And then I said, God, and just think, I mean, how many years? 15, and then, you know, he'll move out, and then maybe he'll come and see us once a week. But he won't really want to, but he'll feel obliged, to. Maybe, like, he'll call once. Maybe he'll move to another city and call once on a Sunday, and there'll be all these things about me which are just inherently embarrassing or annoying to him. And it's just the fate, isn't it? It's the fate. And these years, like 1 to 4 or 1 to 5 or whatever it is, he won't really remember any of it. And I, like, the most intense emotional experiences of my life have been experienced in these years, and only I will remember him.
They rock it by as well. I mean, I still remember my eldest. I still remember putting him in his baby growing and him puking all over me, and that seems like yesterday. And now he's 28, he'll be 29, he's getting married, and now and like my youngest is just, we're gonna set each other up.
Answer me this, like, so if like something I can set myself off by thinking about is, oh, there's going to be a last time when he comes and gets in my bed in the morning and we have a little cuddle and we watch a cartoon. Oh, yeah. There's going to be a time of, like, but you never know when that time is coming. No. So there was a last time, like, I put him in his pram. I didn't know it was going to be the last time. And then all of a sudden he was walking everywhere, going on his bike or his scooter. So that's now a thing of the past. And there was no sort of sense of ceremony. And now we are moving from this phase into this phase. And so, I mean, do you want to go in and look at your 28-year-old sleeping at night? I mean, like, would you love it? Would you love it if they just treated you to one last bath with you?
Two grown men sat. I remember, I just remember, because the mother of my children and I, so we got together in 91 and then we broke up in 93 and we had him, like, he was born 9 months after we met. It was like that. Yeah. And then we spent the 90s getting back together and we finally broke up 2000 for the final time. And they'd come to me at weekends. Every weekend they came to me and it was without fail and it was lovely. And then one day I remember when they went, oh, I'm busy. I'm going out. Oh, and okay.
The rejection?
Yeah, yeah. And now it's, even now I speak, my eldest lives in Bristol and I'll speak to him and go, I feel bad, I haven't seen you. And he's like, I'm busy, Dad. I've got things to do. You know, they've got lives now and it's a really weird feeling.
I can tell if my son, who I say is now 4 and a half, like if he needs a poo, I can tell from his face. Can you tell the same about your grown-up kids?
My eldest has got a beard. They've both got beards. And I look at them and they're like, they're men. And they're both 6'1", 6'2". They're massive.
Yeah.
But now when they're really feeling, when something's troubling them, they're little boys again. And I can tell. And it takes me a lot to get it out. My eldest is more sensitive than my youngest, but I can tell when there's something bothering them. And I'm like, you can come and talk to me. You know, I'm not. What's going on? I can feel something. And then they will. They will tell me. So, my eldest son shits like a horse. So that's how I can tell. I don't know what's wrong with his insides, but I've never smelled anything like it. It's like,
oh my God.
Burnt stuff in oil and petrol, and it's indescribable. He lived with me for a couple of years when he was at dance school, and I don't know what he eats. I think he eats tar. It's not cool. So I don't want to know when he has a shit, when he needs a shit.
Pride about his bowel movements.
I'm going to keep one.
I'm very prolific of bowel. And my son did this shit the other day where it rose up above the water level like the Loch Ness Monster. And I felt like in some way it was an achievement for me. I will do these especially, I don't know if it's something to do with, you know, slight variations in what you're eating, but when I was courting Sarah and I'd go over to the States a lot, I'd do these tremendous shits and they were so impressive that I would feel the need to photograph them and to, like, either show them to her or send them to group of friends. There was this one that, yeah, I'll send it to you if you like. I've still got it in my phone. That we called the brown swan. It rose up vertically out of the, it was like a swan's neck protruding out of the water by, I don't know, 10, 15 centimetres or something.
How the fuck did you do that?
I have no idea.
It's like balloon animals, but with shit.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, well done. You've got a skill.
Finally, I discovered it.
I tell you what was impressive was when I didn't know my eldest was in the bath, and I went in the bathroom and he was there, and I've gone in and, oh shit, sorry mate, and he's like, yeah, Dad, get out. And but I accidentally saw what he was packing and it's quite the beast. And I walked out and I was like, fucking yeah. And there was a sense of pride. I'm like, I made a decent penis.
Oh, I've got my fears.
So you find, well, you find joy in ways, in different ways. You'll find a way. But this has been lovely, Jeff. Thank you so much for your patience and coming on.
No, it's
been
good,
really,
it's good
been
to
really
talk
nice,
to you,
mate.
You know,
it's been lovely. Yeah. You're a nice man. It's been, and it,
I am nice, aren't I?
You are a nice man. And it, and again, like I say, it's surreal knowing you, having listened to you for years. It's weird that I know, like, your name's in my phone. It's odd. Little things like that.
Right, yeah, yeah.
I've had
that with people before.
Have you?
Yeah, no. There's a guy called James H. Reeve, who, when I was a teenager, I used to be, you know, obsessed with, like, listen to in Manchester. He used to do the late night call-in show, and he was, you know, not like one of these kind of right-wing, string-em-up, send-em-back type. Yeah. He was very slow and thoughtful and sarcastic, and Frank Sidebottom used to do sketches on his show.
Oh, wow.
And it was, you know, it's slightly offbeat. And really, I think it was listening to him that made me fall in love with radio and doing radio. And then I got to know him a little bit in later life through working at the local station in Manchester, Piccadilly. And it was always weird to me that, you know, that I could have a conversation with him that wasn't me writing into his radio show or phoning up his radio show.
It is.
I do think, like, audio, there's something about it where, I don't know, it you know, the people who are lucky enough to have a long career out of it, you can't do it without it really showing the listeners who you are, and you feel some kind of connection with them. You do feel like you know them.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny. Yeah, like, especially with this, I actually say to people, look, if you're struggling or you're feeling, just, you can drop me a line. I'll have a chat with you. And I've had other people say, mate, you're opening yourself up a bit there. And I'm like, yeah but I'm not telling them to come around my house.
Yeah,
I'm happy.
Yeah.
I'm quite, especially the way things are now with social media, I'm quite happy to chat away and, you know, and reply to messages and have a conversation. If it gets too weird, then I'll kind of back off a bit. And that's only happened once, but I've kind of gone, when they started saying, oh, can I send you something? Oh, can I come around your house? Oh, do you want to meet up for a drink? And you go, okay, hang on. Yeah.
That's funny. That's not to say if you, like, bumped into that person in the pub and they started chatting to you, you wouldn't enjoy having a drink with
them. No, God, no.
Yeah.
No, God, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, there's someone else, and she said, if you find yourself in town, come and have a cup of tea. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Oh, do you know what? Yeah. I will. So, it's nice. I quite like it, you know. Yeah. I like people, so... Yeah.
See, I really love the idea of people, but I'm never great when I'm amongst them.
I think we worry too much about how we're perceived.
Yeah.
It's like you said, you worry that people, and most people aren't noticing what we're doing. They're all wrapped up in their own stuff. I remember talking to a comedian, Matt Price, and I said to him, I said, I worry that every time I walk away from someone after I've spoken to them, they're thinking, he's a fucking wanker.
Oh, yeah.
And
absolutely.
He went,
absolutely.
and he said, that's quite arrogant, Rich, that you think they're still thinking about you after after you've wandered off.
I can't remember. I'm quite obsessed with Jerry Seinfeld, and I can't remember who I heard him talking to. Probably Howard Stern. There's some great sort of Howard Stern, Jerry Seinfeld interviews. He's like saying, who are these people who, when they're at dinner with a bunch of people and they're telling some story, they haven't got a voice in their head sort of saying, how's this story going down? How is it landing? You know?
Yeah.
But I do think there's a whole bunch of people who just, you know, they say what's in their head and then somebody else's turn to speak. Whereas I think if you've got that external eye thinking, is this going down all right? Are people finding me interesting? Oh, God, that anecdote wasn't a good one. You know, self-commentary.
I do it all the time. I'll find myself halfway. And I do it for a living. That's what I do. And but halfway through, as I'm talking to somebody, I'm like, this story has no end. I don't think it's even connected to what we were talking about.
Do you find in your relationship with Jake, so there are a number of times where Sarah will... I will either say something really... boring or Sarah will tell me a story that's, you know, so dull that one or the other of us will say, you know, she'll either say, oh, you should say that on your podcast, or I'll say, oh, you should make an Edinburgh show out of that anecdote, because there's something about you know, the current situation, and you know we're coming out of it now a bit, but these past few months where you're cooped up and any little thing that is in your head spills out, stuff that usually wouldn't be worth saying. Usually you're able to release the pressure at least by seeing other people and talking to other people. And now we're in the situation where we're together almost 24 hours a day, and just any little brain fart comes out as a nugget of conversation, no matter how dull or not.
We normally say it's either cool story, bro,
or
that's a good one, or we'll say I wouldn't open with it. or the other one, that's a popular one. Or the other one is as you finish saying what you're saying, you go and other interesting things I shouldn't have ever said out loud. It's just like, the other day I had my first gig outside behind this restaurant, and I suddenly realised that I hadn't looked at or listened or done my material in months,
right.
So I couldn't remember any of it, and I'm just talking, and most of it was just garbage. There was no punchlines. I'm just talking about lockdown. I'm like, and all the other comics that had been on previously had talked about lockdown.
This is giving me anxiety hearing this story.
I was just talking utter shit. And I just came away going, I wish I'd not left the house. I wish I was still locked down.
Oh, God, but I could not do your job. You know, at least with radio and podcasts, you can't see people like looking bemused and thinking, why is he saying that?
It's horrible. And I actually said, one of the other comics that was on, a mate of mine, Paul Peary, when he was on, I was stood with her and she was falling about. She's like, oh my God, he's a genius. And I'm like, yeah, he's funny, isn't he? He's funny. And then when I was on, so like towards the end of my set, I could see her, she was on her phone. And I'm like, oh God, like it's all lit up in the gloom. I'm like, oh no. But then driving back, I was dropping him off and I'm like, he went, mate, he goes, that was great. I'm like, it didn't feel great. I could have done this better, that better. And that woman, she was on a phone anyway. And then he looked at his phone and he went, yeah, she's just sent us a friend request on Facebook and she's just said how much she was messaging me.
Right.
While I was on, and right. I just took it negatively.
I would do that. And any sort of confirmation that I am a terrible, dull wanker. That's what I'm looking for in any given interaction.
Yeah, yeah. I'm never thinking, yeah, they think I'm an absolute legend. I'm always like, why am I alive? we'll get through it, Jeff. We'll be all right.
So? We're at least halfway, aren't we?
We're halfway through, mate. Nearly done. Yeah. But I tell you, when this is done, when we can, we can now. We should meet up. We'll have a coffee.
Yeah,
we can make ourselves feel sad.
We can go to Lizzie's on the Green.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, all right, let's do that. Yeah. Yes, let's do that. That'd be great. Where can we find you, Jeff? Online and everything?
You can, find me on Twitter. Twitter is something that just makes me feel bad about myself. I look at other people's follower numbers. I look at mine. I think, why do I bother? I should probably delete
I've had a couple of days off of Twitter and it felt nice.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I think a few of us did, didn't we? But yeah,
we did,
I agree. Actually, when I went on holiday last year, I deleted Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, the news and email off my phone. And I just felt great for having done so and then crept back in. But yeah, I'm on Twitter. There's two podcasts. There's the one I do with Annabelle, which is called Adrift, which is sort of stories of social awkwardness from us and from our listeners. And then there's Reasons to be Cheerful, which is me and Ed Miliband trying to seek out the good ideas to make the world a better place, which was born out of feeling terribly depressed about the state of things and looking to be a bit Pollyanna-ish. But actually, I mean, it's brilliant. Every week we hear from somebody who is either campaigning to do something interesting or they're doing something interesting somewhere in the world, and like anything you can think of, there are smart people thinking of clever solutions.
Lovely. There are. That's the thing. We should trust that. I mean, Pierre Novelli said it on this. He goes, there are people out there looking into this. Whatever it is, they're looking into it. So you just take a seat and let them worry about it. They're the experts. You go and walk around the park with your kids.
Yeah. As Gandhi once said, let someone else be the change you want to see in the world.
And on that, what a wonderful way to finish. Thank you, Jeff.
Cheers, Rich.
Produced by Paul Daniels at pauldaniels.tv.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.